This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Big news! One generous Marketplace fan, Dr. Joe Rush from Florida, is offering to match the next $50,000 in donations to Marketplace. And every single gift gets us closer to a critically important May fundraising goal. So please, give right now and double your impact thanks to this generous match. Go to marketplace.org/donate.
The Consumer Price Index gets a makeover. Time is running out to avoid a government shutdown. And what happened when a small city in the desert feared it was running out of water? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, the 13th of November. Good to have you with us. How have you been feeling about prices lately? Tomorrow, we'll get the latest official report in the form of the Consumer Price Index, and it's expected to show inflation continuing to ease, though still higher than the Fed would like. Quick refresher, the CPI tracks changes in prices for a representative sample of day-to-day living expenses, from housing to food to health insurance. And starting with tomorrow's October release, the Bureau of Labor Statistics is changing how it calculates that last one, health insurance. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino looks at what that means for how we understand inflation.
For a lot of people, health insurance costs equal premiums, according to Stephen Juno, senior economist for Bank of America Global Securities. Bank of America is a Marketplace underwriter.
Everyone's looking at kind of their pay stubs, and you're getting kind of updated premiums from your employer.
Those went up this year by about 7%, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation. Yet, the health insurance index, as measured by CPI, went down this year because it doesn't track health insurance premiums, says Steve Reed, an economist for the Consumer Price Index program.
It's a little more complicated than one might expect or hope.
Because one person's insurance premium doesn't necessarily buy the same thing as the next. Health plans have different benefits, and consumers use them to varying degrees. So the CPI just measures how much health insurance companies retain of those premiums after paying for services. And recently, that's been kind of wacky, says Matthew Fiedler with the Brookings Institution.
One of the big things that happened during the pandemic was people put off a lot of elective care because they didn't want to be going into the hospital. And so insurers did pretty well that year.
That sent the health insurance index up dramatically, then dragged it down again when everyone went back to the doctor in subsequent years.
It's kind of noise that is not reflective of health insurance pricing.
Laura Rosner-Warburton is a founding partner at Macro Policy Perspectives, who helped shape the new BLS methodology. The calculation will now reflect a two-year average of the data, which will be updated more frequently.
It should be a lot less disruptive because it's going to be smoother.
She says the change will likely bump the consumer price index up by a hair for October, but make the stats more meaningful in the long run. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, a mixed bag ahead of that inflation report. We'll have the details when we do the numbers.
Thank you.
Also ahead this week, the deadline for Congress to pass legislation to keep funding the federal government or face a shutdown. Time runs out midnight Friday. If another government shutdown does happen, the last one stretched from December 2018 into early 2019, essential services and mandatory programs would continue. Think Social Security and Medicare, border control and military operations, TSA checkpoints and air traffic control. But hundreds of thousands of federal workers would either be furloughed or required to come to work without pay. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports now on what a shutdown could mean for the larger economy.
We've had government shutdowns before, including in 1995, 2013, and 2018. The first major economic impact we see, says Mark Zandi at Moody's Analytics, is loss of income and a hit to consumer spending.
Obviously, it's a hardship on federal government employees because they don't get paid. Whether they go to work or not, whether they're essential or not, doesn't matter. They're not going to get paid.
In previous shutdowns, that's affected about 850,000 federal workers. Joe Bruzuelas at consulting firm RSM predicts if a shutdown happens this time around,
we would expect a 0.2% drag per week on GDP.
Though some of that economic activity would be made up after the shutdown ended and federal workers got back pay. Meanwhile, economic risks are already rising. Moody's downgraded its outlook on the U.S.'s credit rating on Friday. Mark Zandi can't comment on the agency's likely next steps, but he does have some predictions about what would happen in a prolonged government shutdown.
If it goes on for a month, 6 weeks, things start breaking. TSA workers, they just don't come to work because they go get other jobs because they have to pay the bills, or air traffic controllers. So the airports start getting clogged up and people get really upset at that.
The current fight over government funding and previous brinkmanship over the debt ceiling have damaged the U.S.'s reputation, says Adam Posen at the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
Lack of governance prompted by the successive House Republican leaderships echoes Italy, Argentina, and other fiscal basket cases in a way we haven't seen in the past.
Posen warns there's a cost.
Increasingly, people are going to get worried, and there will be interest rate movements and therefore currency movements and flows of funds.
Out of the U.S. for other developed economies that appear more stable and better run. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
In the arid Southwest, water has always been precious, but the combination of climate change and rampant growth has raised the stakes. More frequent and severe droughts and overpumping of groundwater have left communities searching for new sources and fighting over how to manage the water they have. The new season of our podcast, How We Survive, is all about water and what happens when there's not enough of it, which brought me this summer to the city of Kingman in northwestern Arizona. Kingman has an old school vibe. Route 66 runs through the heart of downtown. Retro neon signs advertise motels and diners.
We get tourists from all over the world. They come through here. It's a straight shot from Las Vegas to the Grand Canyon.
Jamie Staley grew up in Kingman, a city of about 35,000 today. She runs a landscaping business with her husband and serves on the city council.
I wanted to help work on issues that would create a town where my daughters could go to college and there was a lot of opportunity for them to come back.
So it was a little unsettling when about 10 years ago, she started noticing changes.
It really happened overnight.
Farms popping up in the desert, growing thirsty crops like alfalfa and nuts in a region that sees just 5 to 10 inches of rain a year on average.
Nobody would have ever imagined that farms would locate here. I mean, if you had talked about that 20 years ago, you would have been laughed out of the room.
Soon, Jamie grew alarmed.
We realized that our water from our aquifer, which is our only water source, drinking water source for our city, was being depleted at a very rapid rate.
A study by the U.S. Geological Survey found that four times as much water was coming out of the aquifer as was going back in. So Jamie and other local leaders decided to pursue an unusual solution in this rural conservative area. They asked the state to pass strict regulations to protect groundwater, something that hadn't been done in Arizona in 40 years. The move set off a firestorm.
We the people have a God-given right to land and the water underneath that land without regulations.
The state held two public meetings last year, packed with concerned citizens like James Jones, who opposed the regulations.
This is government overreach and violation of your oath of office.
Others, like Randy Perry, wanted the state to step in and stop big corporate farms from draining the aquifer.
All we hear is drought, 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 but yet you're allowing these wells just to go goofy. You got to have some kind of controls.
And last year, the state agreed to designate the Hualapai Valley Groundwater Basin as an irrigation non-expansion area, or INA, a jargony name that means farmers who are already here can keep irrigating their crops, but they can't expand and no new farms can move in.
This is also the airport here, too.
Rocky Dhaliwal is driving me northeast on Route 66 to his farm outside Kingman.
Are these your little baby trees out here?
Yes. Those are newly planted pistachio trees. Newly planted, I mean a year old.
The desert gives way to tidy rows of pistachio trees, almost as far as the eye can see. Rocky farms about 2,400 acres and had plans to expand and build a pistachio processing plant,
which, when the INA got passed there, got put on hold. We cannot do that. We are halfway in the middle of everything, and all of a sudden this got thrown into us that we cannot farm anymore.
So what do you do? I imagine it's hard to sell that land if no one else can farm it.
Right now, nobody wants to buy that land there. You cannot sell it. So we are basically can't do anything with that land.
Other landowners have sued the state of Arizona to try to reverse the rules. They claim the state's decision was based on overly dire projections that didn't take into account actual rates of groundwater withdrawal or steps farmers have taken to irrigate more efficiently. But Councilwoman Jamie Staley says the new rules don't solve the deeper problem.
I think anybody that's familiar with this issue would tell you that the INA was just a first step. Because, you know, the data shows it's not enough.
Officials are working to recharge the aquifer by treating wastewater and injecting it underground. They're also investing in conservation programs to use less water in the first place. Jamie hopes all these things will preserve her rural desert town for her daughters and for generations to come. You can hear more about how communities are adapting to a hotter, drier climate on the new season of our podcast, How We Survive. Coming up.
Bills aren't, like, really destroying me right now.
That's good news. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 54 points, shy of 0.2% to finish at 34,337. The NASDAQ fell 30 points, 0.2% to close at 13,767. And the S&P 500 subtracted 3 points, not quite 0.1%, to end at 4,411. Drivers and pilots have been putting mobile oil into their tanks for more than a century. Now ExxonMobil hopes EV manufacturers will want to put mobile lithium into their batteries. The petro giant announced today it's going to be extracting the metal from wells it's drilling in southwest Arkansas. ExxonMobil gassed up a little over 1%. It's partnering with drilling services provider Tetra Technologies, which added 12.1%. You're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Ascensus, helping people dream bigger, aim higher, and save more with financial confidence. Unleash the power of your retirement savings plan with innovative technology that makes things easy, top-notch service from experts who care, and flexible solutions that can grow with you. For more than 40 years, Ascensus has been helping savers achieve their goals. We can help you achieve yours, too. Learn more at Ascensus.com. That's ASCENSUS.com.
Big news! One generous Marketplace fan, Dr. Joe Rush from Florida, is offering to match the next $50,000 in donations to Marketplace. And every single gift gets us closer to a critically important May fundraising goal. So please, give right now and double your impact thanks to this generous match. Go to marketplace.org/donate.
This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. We talk a lot on the show about monetary policy, specifically how the Federal Reserve sets interest rates in order to stimulate the economy or, more recently, slow it down. The government has another powerful tool at its disposal, fiscal policy, as in spending on programs like Social Security and other benefits, and cutting or raising taxes. A new paper out today from researchers at the San Francisco Fed found that fiscal policy contributed a lot to economic growth over the last few years. But over the next few, that's going to change. Marketplace's Justin Ho has more.
It's been a while since the federal government stepped in and boosted the economy with more than $5 trillion worth of pandemic relief aid.
The enhanced unemployment benefits have expired. The direct checks haven't gone out in quite some time. The Paycheck Protection Program has ended.
That's Michael Puglisi, senior economist with Wells Fargo. He says it's not like the government has reversed course and enacted huge spending cuts or tax increases. Instead, Puglisi says he can think of its current fiscal policy as pretty neutral.
It's neither acting as a material boost or drag on the U.S. economy.
And that's not necessarily a bad thing, says Menzi Chen, an economics professor at the University of Wisconsin. Chen says on one hand, we don't want the government making big spending cuts or tax increases to drag on the economy right now.
There's some worry about a recession coming, and you don't want the spending cuts to hit exactly at a time when you're at a sensitive point in the business cycle.
And on the other hand, Chen says we don't need fiscal policy to boost anything either. Remember, the Federal Reserve is trying to cool down the economy to bring down inflation.
Unemployment is still very low. GDP still seems to be growing quickly.
The economy is still strong in large part because of all that spending the government did earlier in the pandemic. Preston Mui is senior economist at the advocacy group Employ America. He says even though consumers aren't getting any relief aid right now, their finances are still pretty healthy.
Household balance sheets are doing really well in 2022 compared to 2019.
But Mui says we're still not sure how people's balance sheets will change now that the government's fiscal policy is more neutral, especially since student loan payments just resumed and pandemic-era childcare subsidies recently came to an end.
The worry would be that there's lags in how that manifests in the economy and the labor market.
Mui says it'll be important for fiscal policy to keep the economy afloat, especially, he says, as the Federal Reserve's monetary policy continues to slow things down. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
It's been a big year for labor unions and their acronyms. The WGA and SAG-AFTRA have both agreed on contracts with the big film and TV studios. The NLRB has made it easier for workers to organize. And the UAW has agreed to contracts with the big three automakers in the U.S., Ford, GM, and Stellantis, which said today it's offering voluntary buyouts or early retirement to more than 6,000 non-union workers as part of its transition to electric vehicles. One of the big sticking points for the United Auto Workers is how the people who make the cars will fare in that transition. That's something Umair Irfan, a correspondent at Vox, has been reporting on. Umair, welcome to the program.
Hi, Amy. Thanks for having me.
So what are the UAW's concerns about the transition to EVs and how that's affecting workers?
The worry from their end is that the auto manufacturers are building new supply chains and new factories without necessarily expanding the same benefits that unions have fought for to these new production lines. It's not a given necessarily that a new battery plant or that a new electric car assembly plant would be covered under UAW contract. And the manufacturers were saying they wanted to use this as an opportunity to perhaps undermine or to circumvent the UAW. And the union decided to go on strike to ensure that those same protections that they had on existing plants would apply to the new ones.
And so how does the tentative agreement the union reached with manufacturers address those concerns?
They are getting some agreements to extend union protections to these new plants, in particular battery manufacturing. The auto companies argued that batteries are completely different. They're a different part of the supply chain. They shouldn't be covered. But the union was able to flex its muscle and with some of the automakers get an accordance basically saying that those union protections would still apply to workers in EV plants. They also got some protections for workers who are in plants that are perhaps going to close down in the near future. And the union got some language in the agreement that would give those workers some leverage in terms of being able to go on strike, being able to get training, and being able to get the first crack at any new jobs that are being brought to the fore.
You wrote about a working paper that studied the transition from so-called dirty or carbon-intensive jobs to green jobs. And I was struck only 1% of workers who left dirty jobs actually ended up in greener jobs. What are the barriers to that transition?
It is not a given that those people in the traditional energy sector will make the jump towards clean energy. And there's a number of reasons behind that. One of the big ones is just that simply the jobs are not in the same places. The places where you have oil derricks, where you have fracking wells, are not necessarily the places where you're installing wind turbines and solar panels. It's also a different skill set. You know, a person who's really good at milling and boring engines and motors for conventional gasoline vehicles, that doesn't necessarily translate to winding electric motors or dealing with, you know, electrical components in a battery-operated vehicle the way it would in a gasoline or diesel-powered vehicle. So the skill set doesn't necessarily translate. So very likely if somebody loses a job in a fossil fuel or dirty energy industry, they'll very likely end up in a very similar industry because that's where it's easiest for them to make that jump.
What can manufacturers do and perhaps the government do to try to replace those jobs with cleaner jobs in the same area or, you know, train their existing workforce to make that transition from, you know, assembling transmissions to, what did you say, winding electric motors? I'm showing my ignorance here. I didn't know they were wound.
Right. You have to wind copper wire and around magnets and other kinds of things in order to build a motor. But yeah, I mean, essentially, it is a different skill set, which would require a lot of training. And so one of the big things is just to try to anticipate and plan for this, that essentially when you see that the dislocation is coming, to basically start making the investments in the communities and in the workers themselves to help cushion that blow. The National Academy of Sciences recently, they put out a report looking at what it would take to facilitate the transition to clean energy. And one of the things they warned about was that the U.S. safety net, the social safety net across the economy, is really fragile, it's really weak, and it's really inadequate. So things like better unemployment insurance, things like having low-cost training being made available to them. And even after they get new jobs, it's not necessarily a given that those same jobs will be equivalent. So perhaps things like salary support to be able to make up the difference can help facilitate that transition. And for older workers who are near retirement age or who may not have the skills or just the will to go back to school, perhaps the government could help buy out or facilitate early retirement packages for them as well.
Umer Irfan writes about climate change and energy at Vox. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
One of the big things to watch in tomorrow's CPI report that we talked about earlier is the cost of shelter. A month ago, that was one of the main things driving up headline inflation, once you exclude energy and food. So keep an eye out for that. I say that as a lead up to this. Back in May, we heard from three college grads who were just entering the labor force. We've been checking back in to see how things are going now, 6 months later. Closing out the series, we have Tyree White. He graduated from the University of Arkansas Pine Bluff and got a job as a multimedia producer and reporter at KTRE in Lufkin, Texas. And now he's dealing with shelter costs of his own.
Back when we talked in May, I had already had the position. I was already hired. So since then, I've graduated. I've moved out about 3 hours from my hometown. I'm in my own apartment. I'm paying adult bills. Moving back home for what? Maybe like a month. I was home, if that. Then moving out here on my own. I was kind of worried about it before I graduated because I'm like, man, moving 3 hours out. I'm like, how am I going to do this? But my parents, my family, they really like came through for me and got me out here. And I wouldn't be out here without them. I love my living situation right now. It kind of wasn't a big shift for me because living in college, I was already living on my own per se. I just wasn't paying as many bills. But it's not as bad as I thought it would be. I will say that bills aren't just like really destroying me right now. So that's good. But as far as my living situation, it really worked out.
Tyree White, currently living in East Texas. This final note on the way out today, which I spotted in my hometown paper, the Baltimore Sun. Later this week, a 109-year-old baseball card goes to auction, where it's expected to sell for millions of dollars and possibly even approach the record price set last year by a Mickey Mantle rookie card, $12.6 million. The card going up for sale this week was issued in 1914 of one George Herman Ruth, a.k.a. Babe Ruth, who was then a 19-year-old pitcher for the minor league Baltimore Orioles. Its original owner was a paperboy, Archibald Davis, who collected the cards included in the daily newspaper and eventually handed them down to his son. The Davis family sold the cards to a private collector a few years ago, who's now putting them up for auction. Bidding for the super rare Babe Ruth card starts at $2.5 million. Check your closets and attics, people. And here's your moment of economic context, one data point that will tell you a lot about the recent state of the housing market and who can afford to buy homes. The National Association of Realtors said today that the median household income of those who bought homes between July 2022 and June of this year was $107,000, up from $88,000 the year before. Our daily production team includes Andy Corbin, Richard Cunningham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sarah Leeson, Sean McHenry, and Sophia Terenzio. I'm Amy Scott. We'll be back tomorrow. This is APM.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.